Here's Francis Rose.
Welcome to the program for Friday, July 1st, 2011. This is the Federal News Countdown, as we do every Friday at 3 o'clock. And this is a kind of a little bit of a special countdown because it's the last one for 2 weeks. I'm going to be out next Friday, and so no Federal News Countdown. Next week, we're back with a brand new one on the, what does that make it, the 14th or 15th of July, whatever that Friday is. The Federal News Countdown will resume. In studio with me today to count down the stories they've chosen as the three most important federal news stories of the week, Stan Soloway, president of the Professional Services Council. Good to see you, sir. Nice.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you for coming in. Sure. And Lisa Mascolo, formerly of Accenture and a veteran of the federal contracting world. It's great to see you again.
Great to be here.
Happy to have you. You have all chosen, each chosen the stories that you think are the most important federal news stories of the week. You've ranked them in order from number three to number one. We've posted them for you at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. So as we're counting through the stories this afternoon, I invite you to go to the website and you can read through the stories that we are talking about on the countdown. And of course, we always start with
number three.
Stan Soloway's third most important federal news story of the week is from Federal Computer Week. The headline is DOD proposes new cybersecurity requirements for contractors. What are the implications here for example, the companies that you work with at PSC?
Well, I think that the proposed rule, it's a proposed rule, it's not a final rule, it sends certain signals that we still have a lot of work to do to figure out cybersecurity policy both inside of government and with regard to the contracting community. There was an advance notice of proposed rulemaking came out almost a year ago. A number of us made a number of comments about what we thought were gaps and vagaries and overgeneralizations in the rule. The proposed rule came out, and it has some changes to it, but still is very unclear. And I think what it signals to us is a couple of things. One is DOD, which is trying hard to get this right. I mean, we all agree this is a tough issue, so it's not an issue of sort of bashing heads over it. We get it, that's a tough issue, but they're still having trouble sort of defining terms that everybody will understand so you can actually plan accordingly. What does my system have to have? I have company proprietary information I protect. How does that align with what you want me to do for sensitive, unclassified stuff? We're not talking here about secure communications and the secure network, the SIPRNet. Mm-hmm. I think the second thing is that there continues to be signals that as these policies emerge from DOD, Homeland, and elsewhere, we're continuing to see a lot of risk shifting. And when you shift risk, that may be okay, but there's got to be some clarity and some protection.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I don't want to get into the technical details of the rule. We submitted some very extensive comments back with the advance notice, and most of those comments are still relevant to the proposed rule. And again, it's really around – it's vague. There are questions of liability and risk of how a company is supposed to know what certain things are. There's terminology in the rule that only a precious few people are going to have any clue what they're talking about. And so I think that there's just a tremendous amount of work. Elisa probably knows a lot more about this than I, because she was on the front lines of doing this kind of work. But this just strikes me as something that not only because the proposed rule is out, but perhaps more significantly, it continues to signal the uncertainty that surrounds cyber policy
mm-hmm.
and questions that exist around definition, clarity, and consistency.
Are we even at a place, though, when it comes to making cyber policy where we're sure enough of what outcomes we want that clarity is possible?
I think we know what outcomes we want. I don't think we're quite sure how to get there, and I don't think we're quite sure what outcomes for what kinds of information.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's still, you know, this rule has, there's basic protection, and then there's enhanced protection, and then there's, this information that has not yet been classified one way or the other.
It's, right.
And then it flows down to all of your subcontractors. So I think everybody agrees that we've got a huge challenge. I mean, you have to be an idiot not to have seen this in the press over the last several years, and certainly the last several months it's enhanced.
Mm-hmm.
And so DOD is trying hard to get this right. This just signals to me that we're not there yet, and the potential risk of not getting it right in terms of cost, liability, and other is not insignificant to both the government and industry.
Stan Soloway, story number three in the countdown is from Federal Computer Week. The headline is DOD proposes new cybersecurity requirements for contractors. It's Alice Lipovich's story, and we've got it linked up at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Lisa, your number three story is Jason's story headline, more time needed to finalize FedRAMP. FedRAMP is kind of, it's not a delay. Jason was very clear to tell me the other day, but that seems to maybe just be semantics is from what it sounds like.
I think it is somewhat of a delay from the expectations they had originally set sometime in the June timeframe. The FedRAMP is really aimed at identifying the certification and accreditation regulations, rules, if you will, around cloud computing, whether that's platform or infrastructure or software as a service, the intent is to define what it means to be able to do cloud computing in the federal space. One of the things I think that's interesting is I wonder if there's, I don't think it's going to fail. It will get done. Now they're saying August, October, so think early fall. I wonder what Vivek Kundra's departure, what sort of impact that might have. Who else is going to champion this? But I think what's important about it, kind of to Stan's point about the vagaries, the expectation in the contractor community is that it will help define what you need to do in order to have your systems accredited and certified. It can't be one size fits all. It's not going to be all regulations to all agencies for all things that they want to buy. I hope it doesn't go the way of other programs like Dimers that tried to be one size fits all. I think there's a lot of risk. I think it's a really important program. I think it will be very important to the federal employees who are in procurement and the business guys. They're going to have to learn what these new regulations are and apply them in the procurements.
As we get to fall and wait for things to happen, and we're waiting for a replacement for Vivek Kundra, that the longer that there's no replacement for him, the name game seems to continue. Do you think that somebody coming in is more likely to be someone chosen because he or she's willing to continue his policies, or because the administration's looking for another visionary type like him, which may or may not necessarily go in the same direction, depending on whatever his or her vision is?
I would hope. I'm not sure I can speak for anybody and say what I think.
Just your opinion, yeah.
I would hope that it would be somebody who would continue the championing of things like cloud and cybersecurity. When you think about the future in federal contracting and in, you know, federal IT services, these are the top two issues. Somebody's got to own these from a visionary perspective. I wouldn't want to throw six more things into the vision pile.
Lisa Mascolo, story number three is Jason Miller's federalnewsradio.com story, headlined "More Time Needed to Finalize FedRAMP." That, of course, is linked up like the rest of our stories at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Back with story number two for Lisa Mascolo and for Stan Soloway when the Federal News Countdown continues on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power, Grantham University, and MetLife. Now here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
Today we'll learn about AFGE's historic win in the Transportation Security Administration's union election with National President John Gage and Local 777 President Ricky McCoy, as well as Inside Government's five-year anniversary with Communications Director Enid Doggett. But first, President Gage addresses the media at his first press conference after AFGE's TSA election win.
It's a great time for our union and for the union movement. NTU put up a terrific fight in this, and they're damn strong union when it comes to representational elections, and it was really, I think, an heroic effort by both unions. I want to say that I thought that NTU did a very classy thing today, saying that they would not move to appeal the results of the election. It really is a classy move. In fact, AFGE, if we'd have lost, we were going to do the same, because I think that both unions, from their campaigns, know how desperately the TSOs need a union and need a contract. It was very interesting during the campaign, especially when gave some information of the vote totals. And as I was going around and talking to people, TSOs all over the place, there were just so many people that said, "Who are you going to vote for?" "I'm not going to vote for either one. I don't care which one comes in. We just need a union, and we want one of these unions." And other people, especially some of the younger ones, saying, "I can't make up my mind." And it was I think NTU probably felt the same thing. It was it was a little frustrating. Plus, of course, the access to TSOs is always difficult. It's kind of a one-on-one shot at bus stops and trains and in bathrooms and in food courts to try to get access to the potential voters. But so many. I'm just very proud of our activists and also of our union. You know, we fought hard back when TSO was first made, first organized, and fought hard that they be federalized, which they were. And when they came out and said that, well, they can't have a union, we never really admitted to that being a union member was detrimental to national security, and we kept representing them in whatever forums we could, and kept trying to organize them, and pushed hard through the Obama administration to
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station.
Do you know us? We employ more than 70,000 people in more than 800 locations throughout the United States. Through our network of suppliers, we indirectly enable tens of thousands of American jobs. Tens of thousands. Jobs that put food on the table. Jobs that put kids through college. Jobs that keep our economy going. And yet, many of you don't even know who we are. Our name is United Technologies. We are Carrier, Hamilton Sunstrand, Otis, Pratt & Whitney, Sikorsky, and UTC Fire and Security. Six businesses united as one powerful company. We may be the biggest unknown company in America, but our jobs power the economy, and our technologies, products, and services power the world. United Technologies. Get to know more about us at UTC.com.
The Government IT Solutions Spotlight is brought to you by CDWG.
The House of Representatives wants to stop printing so many documents. Instead, lawmakers are looking at how they could use smartphones and tablet computers to view, edit, and send bills, letters, and a host of other documents. The goal is twofold: to save money and to speed up the time it takes for lawmakers to introduce bills and share other documents. House lawmakers spend more than $5 million a year on printing, including $1.7 million on printing bills, of which only 3% become law.
If you're in federal IT, CDWG has the people and products to seamlessly integrate all your communications into a single, unified, accessible communications network. So if your employees are scattered hither and yon, visit cdwg.com/unified. We'll make it seem like they're all hither, not yon. CDWG. People who get it.
Visit CDWG.com to learn how an end-to-end solution from Brocade can help your agency improve network agility and responsiveness.
Profile America, Friday, July 1st. The question of providing health care for elderly Americans and how to pay for it already has been raised often during this year's early skirmishing for the 2012 political campaign. The backbone of our health care system is Medicare, guaranteed medical insurance for those 65 and older. The program went into effect 43 years ago today. The first Medicare cards were issued to former President Harry Truman and his wife, Bess. Now nearly 46 million people are enrolled, more than 7.5 million of them disabled. Each year, the costs of hospital stays and skilled nursing care for Medicare patients comes to $500 billion. You can find these and more facts about America from the U.S. Census Bureau online at census.gov.
Wake up and drive in with Tom Tamman and Amy Morris on the Federal Drive. It's your early line on the day ahead from your trusted advisors. Tom and Amy give you a full view of the issues. Find out what your colleagues in other agencies are up to and what policy and congressional developments mean to you. The Federal Drive with Tom Tamman and Amy Morris. Weekday mornings from 6 to 10 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
We're back on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. It's the Federal News Countdown with Stan Soloway of the Professional Services Council and Lisa Mascolo in with me on counting down the stories they've chosen as the three most important federal news stories of the week. And we're up to...
Number two!
Second most important story is chosen by Lisa Mascolo from the Washington Times. And the headline is $750,000 in London to strike over cost-cutting austerity plan. What does this have to do with the United States federal government, Lisa?
Well, I think it's a very interesting look at the potentials in this country, right? We've got this terrible debate raging over deficit and debt and how to attack them and what are the implications. We've seen what's gone on in Greece. We've seen what's gone on in Wisconsin. It's interesting to think about 750,000 civil servants in the UK going on strike, everything from airport screeners to school teachers to bus drivers. I wonder if people think about what are the implications in this country. As these guys on the Hill start thinking about where they're going to cut costs, what are the implications for federal workers? And it makes you, it certainly made me think, geez, I wonder if federal employees are thinking about this and whether there's any connection.
When I saw that Lisa picked the story, I sort of smiled and thought, okay, same question you had. Then I was thinking much the same way Lisa was about its relevance. But the interesting thing to me about the Brits is that they are about 8 to 12 months ahead of us on austerity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they did their cuts.
Mm-hmm.
They made decisions last year on 20% cuts to all their ministries, 8 or 10% in defense. One of the ironies is we are now criticizing them for cutting their defense budget too much.
Right.
But so they've been through the cut process, and now this is sort of 6 months later, the impact is being felt, and people are now reacting.
Mm-hmm.
So I think to Lisa's point, I don't necessarily think that it's going to go this far in this country, though we've certainly seen it in some states. The decision-making process here is just step one. Once it actually is felt throughout the system, that becomes step two. And that's sort of what England's going through now.
It really is going to be fascinating to see how this debt deficit discussion debate turns out. You know, when I think about federal employees, fully a third are represented by the various unions. It'd be interesting to see what position those folks take at the table or what position they're invited to have at the table and how this is all going to shake out.
And the one key difference is that the Brits actually have cut significantly into their civil service benefits and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
There are, at this point at least, it may well be coming, no proposal on the table to
Correct.
Cut, but there are salary caps, salary freezes. There's going to be probably a personnel freeze. You know, I don't think from our perspective, and I don't think from the government's perspective, that's really very helpful because there are areas in which the government desperately needs people. There's
mm-hmm.
areas in which the government desperately needs to pay more money to get the right people. It, to me, and a lot of people, you wouldn't run a company that way. So there are huge differences. But to Lisa's point, we sit here having this debt ceiling debate, which is, you know, critical. And you watch with Greece, you watch England, as she said, you watch Wisconsin. Minnesota shut down last night.
Mm-hmm.
This is a long slog.
I saw an article in the Los Angeles Times along the same line where to try to cut their budget deficit, state of California now is making Amazon and other companies that do business online in their state collect sales tax. And Amazon now telling affiliate marketers, I had no idea after reading that article that affiliate marketing was such a big deal, but if you're into photography, you set up links on your website about photography or whatever, and you make a little cut when somebody buys something from Amazon. People make enough money off of that they're talking about moving out of the state of California because Amazon will no longer pay those affiliate commissions. So the unintended consequences from a lot of these, I don't think people have a grasp on where these all may lead.
And that was really sort of my thinking around this. Exactly to your point, Stan, the UK's done this stuff, made the cuts. They're 8, 9, 10 months old at this point, and now dealing with the implications and the repercussions of such. It's going to be fascinating to watch it unfold here.
Mm-hmm. As we try to figure out where all of these things might go, and we look at, is it fair to use UK as a model for this to say that's what happened there and the same thing could potentially happen here? Is there a roadmap there?
No, I don't think there's a roadmap in that sense. I don't think Lisa's point is that we're going to expect to see a million civil servants on the streets, although we saw thousands in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
But Wisconsin was doing more of what the UK was doing. They were actually cutting benefits and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't necessarily see that happening. I think that all of this comes back to, and when we get to my number two story, I think it all gets back to, we're so often having the wrong discussions and the wrong debates around what's really going on. Even when you mention the Amazon case and the internet taxing and so forth,
mm-hmm.
you know, as the web has become a major marketing force, there are really interesting questions around what do you do on, with sales taxes?
Mm-hmm.
What do you do with those traditional sort of revenue sources, and what are the implications? That's a whole discussion. The problem is we only have it in a crisis. I need more money, I'm going to slap a tax, rather than step back and try to build a strategy over time that says, all right, the world is changing. You know, 60% of the people are buying stuff online now. How do you actually deal with the revenue implications of that?
So, or the lost revenue implications.
Or the lost, that's what I mean, right, the lost revenue implications.
Mm-hmm. One of the things about this that I think is really fascinating is a complaint that I have not heard yet is the whole term limits issue coming back when it comes to the problems in Congress and in some cases in the states. And it would be interesting to go and look at the states where term limit rules were passed in the state legislatures and see what effect that has had on their fiscal standing. Because one of the things that I think we're going to find is that whatever solution is found in the debt limit deal here in Washington, I think it's going to be found by the people who have been here for a while and who understand not just deal making, but understand really how all of this stuff works, and by the staff members in particular, who understand where the bodies are buried and how all of these things are interconnected.
I agree with you, but I think that the piece that we've got to focus on, and I'm not making a political statement here one way or the other, is that what we're seeing is we can all complain, and legitimately so, about the quality of debate, the lack of intellectual integrity on both sides, and all these things. Lisa and I were talking about before we came into the studio. The reality is that part of what's taking place, I hate to use such a hackneyed phrase, but this is a battle for hearts and minds. I mean, there are folks who came in the last election, whether you agree with them or not, whether you think they're absolutely right on target or absolutely way out of line, deeply believe philosophically in what they're doing. They are actually trying to fundamentally change how the government operates.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
I
and
mean,
so
I don't...
that's the wedge that makes it really difficult to move this.
Yeah.
I think most of them actually are consistent with that thinking, right? They honestly believe they're doing the right thing. And the extreme partisan rhetoric they somehow really think is going to contribute. I love your point about the staff, right? I think we got to pin at least half our hopes on the staff behind the scenes actually making this work, mm-hmm. and figuring out how to get the pieces together.
Lisa Mascola, story number two in the countdowns from the Washington Times. The headline is $750,000 in London to strike over cost-cutting austerity plan. You can read it at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Stan Soloway's story number two in the countdown continues on In Depth with Francis Rowe.
Meeting mission goals through technology, brought to you by General Dynamics Information Technology.
Medicare is about to deploy some of the same technology tools credit card companies use to spot fraud. A new system going into effect on the 1st of July is designed to automatically flag Medicare claims that might be fraudulent by scanning through information about the beneficiary, the provider, the type of service, and other patterns. Staff will then be able to investigate claims the system flags as high risk. By some estimates, healthcare fraud costs the government up to $60 billion a year.
General Dynamics Information Technology is dedicated to providing the latest, highest quality information technology services and resources to help organizations meet their mission objectives. Large-scale IT systems and communications networks are the strategic and operational heart of defense, intelligence, civilian government, and private business. They require the expertise of a company that delivers results. General Dynamics Information Technology, information technology and professional services. Go to GDIT.com to learn more. That's GDIT.com. Newsmakers on In Depth with Francis Rose.
Deborah Vess is the Associate Chief Information Officer at the Treasury Department and leads the HR Connect Program Office. She's also a Causey Award winner.
On the system that we created, which is Entry on Duty, it's about the onboarding process. And this product is really what we call one-to-many. So it's very exciting from a technology perspective to define a product that can actually be leveraged across many different agency and bureaus' needs, because they all do something a little different.
Hear the entire interview online, federalnewsradio.com/in-depth.
When every moment matters and a hand reaches out, when someone gives blood and a life is saved, that moment when heartbreak turns to hope, you're there through the American Red Cross. Every day, the Red Cross responds to nearly 200 neighborhood emergencies, and your support makes it possible. Use this moment to join us today. Visit redcross.org.
Welcome to today's lottery drawing. And today's winning numbers are not yours, not yours, and another number that's not yours. And the final number is not yours.
When it comes to having money, don't rely on luck. Brew your own coffee at home instead of buying that latte. Brown bag it to work instead of ordering in. Go to feedthepig.org for more free ideas on how to save.
Feedthepig.org.
This message brought to you by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and the Ad Council.
This July 4th, you'll be watching fireworks amid sparkling arrays of red, white, and... well, did you ever notice the blues just aren't as good? Bursts of blue fireworks just don't have the same brightness or intensity of other colors, says Washington College chemistry professor John Conkling.
In order to get a bright color up in the sky, you need high temperature. And the chemicals that emit blue light are not stable at high temperatures.
Chemists have been trying to engineer a solution for years, but Conkling says so far, no luck.
Countries do have red, white, and green as their national colors. They're very fortunate. We chose red, white, and blue, so it's harder here in the U.S. to get our national colors up there in the sky on the 4th of July.
To find out more about this and other engineering innovation stories, please go to www.nae.edu/radio. That's www.nae.edu/radio. With the National Academy of Engineering, Randy Atkins, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Hi, this is O'Donna Matthews. What does three decades of service add up to? For the Capital Area Food Bank, it includes these important numbers. Distributing 25 million pounds of food to nearly 500,000 people through a network of 700 partner agencies. 30 years, it's a long time. But the mission continues to make sure that no one is left hungry. To learn more, contribute, or volunteer, visit CapitalAreaFoodBank.org.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Every week on the Federal News Countdown, two people who are experts in the world of the federal government and the business world that revolves around it choose the news stories that they think are the three most important federal news stories of the week, rank them in order from number three to number one, and count them down with me in studio on the Federal News Countdown. This week it's Lisa Mascolo and Stan Soloway. And Stan, your story number two is from InsideDefense.com, and the headline is Senate authorizers call for $1.1 billion in cuts to DOD contract services. Other than the fact that you're quoted in this story, what I always have to tease you about that. What is it about this that makes this important in your mind?
Well, what's important about it has nothing to do with the fact I'm quoted in it, nor the actual headline itself. The $1 billion in cuts, you know, across a universe of $170 billion. It's not the cuts.
Mm-hmm.
It's really an extension of the conversation we were just having. Is that in this continued sort of grasping at fiscal straws that we see taking place, they're sort of putting things in here, these sort of arbitrary, we're going to, it's no different than saying we're going to freeze federal employees' salaries. It doesn't really mean a lot. I mean, at the end of the day, with contractors, I mean, look, if the budget goes down, if spending goes down, contractors will be cut and they will lose their jobs. They actually go away when the mission stops or is reduced.
Right.
That's going to happen as a course of business as the government austerity process and program kicks in. So throwing something into a bill says directing $1 billion in cuts actually, to me, struck me as just another sign of that's not what this issue is about.
I mean, mm-hmm.
As we skinny down programs, as we skinny down requirements, even this year with the late appropriations and the backlog agencies have, everybody knows that the process has slowed down. Things the government wanted to do this year will be pushed to next year. What does that mean? There are people who aren't getting jobs or are losing jobs and so forth. So it's a course of business. So it's sort of connected to the discussion we just had about what's going on in London and sort of the bigger fiscal question.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it struck me that they actually bothered to put this in the bill. The $1 billion will mean nothing in the deficit.
Right.
There are other elements of the bill that are actually troubling because they too speak to some of this, like putting an executive, there are in federal contracting, there is a cap on what company executives' compensation can be relative to the contract. So in other words, how much you can bill the government relative to your. Now that cap is going to extend to all employees, according to the Senate bill. Does that really have an effect? I don't really know. There's not too many places where employees who are working frontline billable hours are making more than the president of the company. But it could have some weird effects when you get down to bonus schedules and all that. But again, it's one of these sort of arbitrary little things that you step back and say, what problem are we trying to solve? We're dealing with a much bigger issue. DOD has been, over the last couple of years, aggressively, in some cases inappropriately, but in other cases very appropriately, trying to rebalance and rebuild its workforce capabilities. They desperately need to do that. It needs to be done strategically, not with these sort of kind of arbitrary little targets thrown out in law.
I don't think it's a problem so much, though, Stan, as it is that members of Congress want to make sure that constituents are getting a message, which is we're not going to allow the people, whether it's true or not, people who are big time, fat cat, whatever derogatory adjective you want to attach to it, to do so on the federal trough. So it seems to me it's more a message than an actual problem.
More than that, for instance, I think the message to DOD, and I understand it. I just don't think it has a lot of value when you put it into a statute. Maybe you put it in report language or something. But the message to DOD is, as we freeze salaries, there is a personnel freeze throughout much of DOD, if we in fact do find the Congress deciding to cut FTE, we don't expect you to just automatically be replacing these folks with contractors. I mean, that would defeat the purpose. My point here is that this is not to debate the provision, although I think it's sort of a silly provision, but to really again point out that we're still not letting agencies do what they need to do, which is get innovative and efficient. We're trying to do it by fiat, and you can't do it that way.
Another interesting quote from this story, a fellow quotee, Jack Gansler.
My former boss.
Yes. Talked in this story about something that I think is a microcosm, what's going on at DOD, a microcosm of the entire federal government. And he mentions rising fuel and medical costs. Now, you may recall when GM was having its financial problems. The head of GM said, we're a healthcare company that makes cars. And this whole conversation, we're, what, a year or so now that healthcare reform's been passed, and everybody's mind is wrapped around this whole concept of healthcare costs. It literally is affecting everything that's going on.
Well, I think I agree with you. And again, not to go back to the London thing, but sort of, right? What is the percentage that employees, whether they're federal employees or private sector employees, should contribute to their health care, right? That's going to continue to be part of this raging debate. You know, I think, Stan, to some of the points you were making, I agree with you that there seems to continue to be a kind of a one-size-fits-all mentality to try and solve the problems. And it's really about how we get smaller, smarter, faster, cheaper in the federal government. How do we get nimble? How do we do that quickly? That's the nut that has yet to be cracked in my mind when we start talking about these regulations.
Right. And somebody said to me yesterday in a session I was in that there seems to be this I forget what word they use, we would consider sort of unbridled passion for cost savings, even at the expense of innovation. And I looked at the person and I said, if you're being innovative and you're not saving money, I can't afford your innovation.
Right.
So we clearly need to get there. I'm not arguing with the intent. Again, it's symbolic of kind of this. We came out of this sort of insourcing wave at DOD where the secretary set a number and he was really trying to do workforce balancing and it turned into a budget drill that had no real relevance to reality. And Congress has kind of pushed back against that. Yet these little things keep coming up and the message it sends across the workforce can be troubling. So I suggested it as a story, not because of the $1 billion cut, because of the signal and the continuing nature of the dialogue and debate we're seeing.
Just one more point on that. I think it was a Jason Miller story. I don't remember what day it was this week. I think it was this week he interviewed Beth McGrath.
Yeah.
And one of the points that she made in that discussion was this notion of agile development, which I think going forward is really key, right? The feds have got to figure out how to be smaller, smarter, faster, cheaper as it relates to a particular outcome.
The hardest part for that, I think, is going to be cultural, and we can talk about that more later. On the Federal News Countdown, story number two from Stan Soloway is from InsideDefense.com. The headline, Senate authorizers call for $1.1 billion in cuts to DOD contract services. You can read that and all of our stories on the Countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Back for story number one from Stan Soloway and Lisa Mascola when the Federal News Countdown continues.
NBC News Radio, I'm Tom Costello. The former head of the IMF is not getting his passport back, but Dominic Strauss-Kahn is free from house arrest. Prosecutors told a judge today there are questions about the credibility of the hotel housekeeper who accused Strauss-Kahn of sexual assault. But the Manhattan DA, Cy Vance, made it clear the case still stands.
Today's proceedings did not dismiss the indictment or any of the charges against the defendant.
Other news here in Washington, only a brief 4th of July recess for the Senate. Lawmakers are back Tuesday to work on a debt reduction package. This morning at the Pentagon, Leon Panetta took the oath of office to become the nation's next defense secretary. He then sent a video message to U.S. troops worldwide.
As Secretary of Defense, I will work to ensure that our nation continues to have the best trained, the best equipped, and the strongest military in the world.
And welcome Thaddeus McCotter to the presidential race. The five-term conservative Republican Michigan congressman makes it official tomorrow. I'm Tom Costello, NBC News Radio.
How's it going? My name is Amy, and I work at Lowe's. July 4th is finally here, and we've got everything you need for a home improvement weekend. Like right now, get 18-month special financing on purchases of $299 or more when you use your Lowe's consumer credit card. Or maybe it's time for a new appliance. Stop by and get 15% off all Energy Star appliances priced $397 or more. Lowe's, let's build something together. Offers valid through 7/4/11. Special financing cannot be combined with 5% off everyday credit offer. See store for details.
Want a more colorful 4th of July? Ask Sherwin-Williams and save 30% on paints and stains during the Great American Painting Party, June 26th through July 4th. With colors like Red Bay, White Tail, and Blue Sky, Independence never looked better. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams paint store and save 30% today. Find your nearest store at sherwinwilliams.com/sale. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Hey, everybody, it's David and Nikki Nellis for Foodie and the Beast, the D.C. area's one and only food and wine variety show. We're going to be off for the holiday weekend, but we put together a great collection of some of our greatest hits segments. Yes, we've been on long enough to have greatest hits. So tune in next Sunday for great chefs, great food, great conversation, and more right here on Foodie and the Beast at 11 on 1500 and 820 a.m.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The Federal News Countdown this week with story selection by Stan Soloway, the Professional Services Council, and Lisa Mascolo. And we are up to on the countdown. Lisa Mascolo, your number one most important federal news story of the week's from the Washington Post. The headline is TSA loss becomes NTEU campaign issue. The TSA screeners selected the American Federation of Government Employees as the union to represent them in collective bargaining. And Colleen Kelly, up for re-election as president of the NTEU, is finding that this is something that at least some people, there's a big debate inside the union how many people care about it, but some people at least seem to care about that inside the union.
I think it's a very interesting story, right? A third of the federal employees are represented by one union or another. A fair number of them are NTEU. It's not just Treasury. It covers a bunch of folks. And she's been in place for 12 or 13 years. And the individual who is her opponent, this guy Eddie Walker, is a chapter president. So it sort of sets up a very interesting, in my mind, sort of governance story. It's kind of the story of central top-down versus how do we get the affiliates in the mix and what's the voice of the chapter and how are, you know, are the people in the individual chapters fairly represented? I think it's going to be interesting to see how this unfolds. In the article, I think Ms. Kelly was quoted as saying she didn't really think it was going to become a campaign issue.
Mm-hmm.
I think it gives him an interesting platform, and certainly what I've seen of both of their campaigns, he seems to be more of a campaigner, not to say that my sense is that she's just continuing to do the business and not worrying about it, but he seems to be much more of a campaigner.
The article by Joe Davidson says he, referring to Eddie Walker, used the same argument when he failed to oust Kelly 4 years ago and won about 15% of the vote by chapter delegates. I believe he'll get the same results as last time, Kelly said. What do you think about that, Stan?
Well, at the risk of, again, using a hackneyed phrase to quote Lloyd Benson, I know Colleen Kelly, and Colleen Kelly's kind of a friend of mine, and I admire her a lot, and I don't know Eddie Walker, so... I think that Lisa's points are well taken. The other thing is that it, just back again to our previous conversations about the whole fiscal debate, the status and future of the federal workforce, which is so essential, you know, that's going to be the core debate. It's going to be kind of an insurgency versus somebody who actually really knows the system and knows the big picture of stuff. And the unions need leadership right now. And I obviously disagree with them on a number of issues, but somebody, they need experienced, knowledgeable, deep leadership. And those who know Colleen, I think, would agree that she is one of the smarter people around and has been around for a while. So it's sort of a microcosm of the bigger political picture,
Absolutely,
right? You get this sort of insurgency against somebody who's no slouch on the issues. I mean, in terms of her, you know, it's not like she's a softy.
Right.
Or, you know, some entrenched, you know, long-standing hack or anything. She's a pretty bright woman. But I think it will be interesting from that perspective because what a lot of people think the unions need is strong, knowledgeable, thoughtful leadership, because they're going to have some very, very tough issues, far beyond organizing issues and debates.
And that's really the crux of it, I think, is the sense that I take from I looked at his campaign website and some other resources that I found online. I don't know him. I've never interviewed him. I've interviewed Colleen on a number of occasions. But I got the sense that that was the focus of his campaign was, how do we be like the union, like unions have always been? And the sense that I take away from what Colleen has talked about historically and what she's talking about now is, how do we deal with the situation in which we find ourselves today?
Yeah, and again, we're not union members. I'm not part of the workforce. So, you know, who am I from the outside to judge it? But if you can spend your time arguing over losing a battle in the field over an organizing campaign, or you can step back and say, we got some much bigger issues. Remember, in the federal government, even if you're not a paying member of the union, you are represented if your organization has a bargaining unit. Mm-hmm. So, there may only be a couple of 100,000 people who pay dues to AFGE, but they may represent 800 or 900,000 people. So they have responsibility across a pretty wide swath. So be interested to see how that plays out.
I think
out.
That's a really important point, right? I think it's about a third are represented, to your point, and really only probably about 21 or 22% of the workforce are dues-paying members. Mm-hmm. And this is an interesting potential revenue loss as well. You're talking about $12 to $16 million in revenue as a result of dues going to one union or another.
Like industry, the public employee unions, and again, I say this without any judgment. I don't mean this in a political sense. The public employee unions have a tough issue. We in industry face this all the time. The issue we just talked about, $1 billion in contract cuts, the issue of insourcing, where is it appropriate, where is it not? There's always a parochial interest at play, and we get it. We're open about it. We try to be, at least I try to be, Lisa tries to be objective in our discussion. The unions have a very similar issue. They're facing an enormous retirement wave at some point. They're facing a young workforce that is probably not as naturally inclined to unions as in the past. Right. They're probably going to be more higher educated, which decreases the inclination to join unions. And they're looking at potential issues like, which I would not support, but FTE reductions and so forth. They have a market issue mm-hmm. that they have to worry about, and I sympathize, because that's a very, very tough challenge.
And for me, that seems to be what Eddie Walker was trying to make this campaign come down to. It really is, again, to your point, it's about the hearts and minds and capturing those hearts and minds.
Lisa Mascola, story number one in the countdown this week is from the Washington Post, Joe Davidson's column under the headline, TSA Loss Becomes NTEU Campaign Issue. You can read it and all of our stories, including Stan Soloway's number one story at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. We'll talk about it when In Depth continues on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Millman from AFMA, the Army and Air Force Mutual Aid Association. For over 132 years, we've been protecting soldiers, airmen, and their families with low-cost life insurance. We've also been caring for survivors of members with unique survivor assistance services. At AFMA, we understand the many challenges that military families can face during their service and after the loss of a loved one. As a nonprofit membership association, AFMA always focuses on what is in the members' best interest. That means offering the best prices on life insurance for military personnel and the best services for survivors. And it also means offering policies with no war, no aviation, and no terrorism clauses or surcharges. For a free quote on life insurance, call the membership coordinator at 1-877-398-2263 or visit us online at AFMA.com today. That's AAFMAA.com.
Here's Colonel Han Pack, the CIO of MedCom G6 U.S. Army, on the Federal Executive Forum on Healthcare IT, sponsored by McAfee.
We're still in a healthcare delivery system that incentivizes more care, more widget counting. And until that changes, until we are incentivized to take technologies that can improve the value of healthcare, until that happens, we really aren't going to get to that state.
To listen to the whole program made possible by Trezza Media Group, log on to federalnewsradio.com.
The rapid rise in cybersecurity threats and compliance requirements make protecting citizens' confidential information increasingly challenging. McAfee is the standard throughout federal, military, intelligence, and civilian enterprises worldwide. McAfee's capabilities are essential to assuring federal networks remain resilient against the latest cyber threats. To learn more about how McAfee can help your organization combat cybersecurity threats, call 888-VIRUS-KNOW or go to McAfee.com/government.
The Federal News Radio Community Spotlight is the Washington Regional Transplant Community. Organ and tissue donations save lives. 1,800 people are on the list for an organ transplant in our area. Many of them are children. Save a life now by registering to be a donor at the DMV or online at beadonor.org. Everyone has the power to save someone's life. Register now at beadonor.org. This message brought to you by Papa John's and Federal News Radio.
Federal News Radio in a Web 2.0 world. Find Federal News Radio on Facebook and Twitter. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/FedNewsRadio or join the Federal News Radio group on Facebook. Chat with our team and make connections with others in the federal arena. Email us at fnrcomment@federalnewsradio.com. Visit our website, federalnewsradio.com. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, your source for federal news now.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The number one federal news story of the week is chosen by Stan Soloways from the Washington Examiner. The headline is Unemployment Rises as Government Tightens Wallet. And as I scan through the story, I noticed that you're quoted in this story, too.
You know, I'm not going to tell you why I chose this story because I don't want to be inappropriate, but it had nothing to do with that, Francis. It was really because I wanted to give you something to think about and maybe challenge you a little intellectually.
I love that. I love
it's
that.
Always a challenge.
And I need
you
that.
You know, you do.
I need that. I need to stretch my brain. The idea here is very compelling because we have said, not just the three of us, but it's kind of been understood over the years that the D.C. area will always be fine because we have the federal government to rely on. The federal government's always going to be chugging along doing what it's doing. And as we step back and think, as we talked about earlier, about unintended consequences and austerity measures and budget reductions and so on, and then what you talked about in your story number two also, Stan, we're seeing on federalnewsradio.com right now Lockheed Martin in the southeast laying off employees, and somebody here in the Bethesda office has to oversee that operation. It's not fair to say anymore, is it, that the D.C. area's economy is going to be fine just because the federal government's here?
Well, it's clearly not as recession-proof as some had hoped or thought. I think that the significance of this story obviously is the obvious part, that it reminds us again that in this region, government is the industry, and that includes federal employees, it includes the military, it includes contractors, universities, and others. I mean, there's a whole ecosystem supporting the government, and as the government faces tremendous funding challenges, as we had a late appropriations this year, an unusually late in-year cuts, a very uncertain FY12 ahead of us. I don't think too many of us are really confident we're going to see an appropriations bill on October 1st. The Senate hasn't even said when they're going to start really doing their allocations at the committee level. So you look at that and you realize that from a regional perspective, it does have a real effect. Now, this region is always going to be better off than some because the government isn't going away. But I think what this story points out, it's one of the first that's come out, is that there are now chinks in the armor starting to show in ways they haven't shown before. We know in our own market, of course, the data lags a long time, but the anecdotal and early data suggests that for the first parts of this current fiscal year, we don't have recent data, the market was relatively flat, which is a heck of a lot better than some parts of the country. But there's clearly an impact, and now you start freezing employee salaries in the federal government. What does that do to the regional economy? What does that do to people's purchasing power? What does it do to the tax base? Similarly with contractors. So, yeah, the whole point here is that, you know, we're not fat and happy. I think people knew all along, as this has been building, that we're going to feel some of this. Now we're starting to see a little bit more of it, and probably more this year than last year, and potentially next year we'll see it even more.
What I think is interesting, Lisa, too, is that this kind of situation has the potential to take longer to play out than it does in other parts of the country, because if you look at a market like Charlotte, where the banking industry is very prevalent, there aren't as many layers to the market. A bank experiences difficulties, it lays people off, those people are unemployed, that's pretty much it. They get reabsorbed into the workplace whenever they can. Here, with the procurement process, with the budget process, and all of the processes that are added on, layers
player-wise, it will take longer to play out. And I wonder if that doesn't mean on the back end it's going to take longer to cycle through and get good again.
I like the analogy of layers. And I believe it was a Fed News Radio story last week. I think I heard Mayor Gray talking to a California company, MVM or something like that, that's moving its manufacturing from California to the district. And I like the idea of layers. And I think part of what the leadership needs to step up to do, whether it's in the district or in Maryland or Virginia, is to figure out what are the other layers. I think your point's right. The ripples are slower, and then therefore they're going to last longer.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're not trying to be doomsayers here. You know, over the last year, you've had major companies move their headquarters to Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
We had 40 or 50,000 jobs added earlier this spring. It's slowed down since. But there's clearly a ripple effect that people just don't think about enough when we think about this. That does not, by the way, the reason for the government to do anything particular with the budget. It's more a cautionary tale for us,
right?
And as we sit here, because it's the wrong reason to go spend the tax dollars to make sure you buck up the Northern Virginia or Maryland or D.C. economies, because you have to focus that on what the mission needs are and revenues and so forth. But I thought it was interesting that there are now some chinks in that armor, and it was not insignificant. It was beginning to show. The other point, the last point on this is, again, we're not doomsaying here. I don't think this economy is going to collapse. I think the market's going to do fine ultimately in the long run. But because of the kinds of fiscal pressures we face, we're not going to see a quick shot up in spending. This is going to be a long cycle of downward spending. It's not going to be like the 90s where we had a year or two of austerity and then, boom, we're back to spending.
The phrase is new normal that we keep hearing over and over again. Stan Soloway's number one story in the countdown is from the Washington Examiner. The headline is Unemployment Rises as Government Tightens Wallet. A terrific Federal News Countdown, folks. Thank you both for being here, Lisa Mascolo and Stan Soloway. The stories that we counted down today are posted on federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, and you can read them there anytime you want. Coming up on In Depth with Francis Rose, after 3 decades of working in the federal government, Deborah Philippi on the outside now. You'll hear from her next on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.